So welcome everybody to this first class of the session 8. We're continuing with our exploration of the time materials that are in knowledge of time and space. And I continue to find them really, they're, in one way they're very challenging, but in another way they're just so clear. I'm really struck by how clear Rinpoche, how clearly Rinpoche presents the difference, you could say, between the vision, this second level vision, and our ordinary understanding. So it's a real gift, and I hope we're able to communicate some of it. Let me say before we get started that a couple of technical or practical things to think about. One is I'm not going to be able to make the class on November 22nd. That's, I guess, three classes from today. So we'll have to skip that week, and that means that we will end a week later on December 14th. Which I hope won't interfere too much with people's Christmas planning. The other related point is that we will have a session on November 29th, which is the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. And I realize some of you may not, especially you know, those of you in the U.S. where Thanksgiving is a big deal, may not be able to make that, but I hope most of you can. The other timing issue is the retreat that's coming up. I'd just like you to start thinking about that a little bit. So we have a retreat planned for June 7th through 12th at Ratna Ling. And there's maybe still a little flexibility in that timing. So if you'd like to come to the retreat but can't do it right then, let me know, or let Kathleen know maybe better. But I hope some of you will start planning on being at that retreat, especially those of you who are in the teacher training. So please start thinking about that. It's only a little more than 6 months away. Well, 7 months away at this point. Okay. So now let's go into the materials. And as I said in the orientation, it's, you know, we took a 1 week break and we switched from session 7 to session 8, but that's just our structure that we're imposing on the material. The material is moving right along. And so we're continuing to work with the same themes that we have been working with in session 7. And there's a special focus on momentum and dynamic, the momentum and the dynamic of time. So actually, I want to start off by going a little bit by going back to the last reading and going to page 76, which is the last page of the last reading, where Rinpoche talks about the momentum of time and sort of sets up what we're going to be looking at today. So he's talking about the movement of time and the origin of that movement. And he's saying, you know, he makes it very clear that he's not talking about the origin as being a particular point in time, which is always, of course, a stumbling block when philosophers get into this or scientists or whoever, you know, what was happening in the moment before time began. He's not interested in that question right here. He's asking about this momentum that keeps time moving. It's the flow of our lives, the dynamic that goes from, you could say, from moment to moment, although that's already saying a little bit too much because it presupposes a linear structure. But it's the way we usually think about it. In any case, there's a dynamic and a movement, and he's asking, so where does that come from? The momentum, he says, this is on 76, about 12 lines down. We're asking about the origin of the momentum between measured out moments, the momentum that sets those moments up and makes them possible. And And then he says, well, what if we just kind of wiped out that momentum of time tried to see, well, where does it come from if you wipe it out? And he says, then the momentum, the usual kind of linear momentum, the momentum that the self depends on to make its stories, that's just gone. But nonetheless, somehow it originates, and it seems to originate in the temporal dynamic. Right? So he says, how can, at the very bottom of 76, he says, how can the momentum of time, how can momentum be its own source? Is there an aspect of momentum that we haven't taken into account, or does time present an energy more fundamental than momentum? And that's really what we're going to be exploring, especially here at the beginning. I think for these next 2 weeks, we're going to be exploring it kind of extensively. And the kind of fundamental thing to see here and to, you know, try to get clear on, and we've talked about this in different ways for weeks now, what's the relationship between momentum and dynamic? At one point of several weeks ago, I was saying, well, momentum, that's when the time, when the self kind of gets involved and you get this temporal momentum, which is the linear momentum, and dynamic is the more fundamental element that he's referring to here at the bottom of page 76. But here he's using the word momentum or here he first says, well, maybe there's an energy more fundamental than momentum. But then when we move on to the reading for today, he says, there's a second level momentum, right? So the very beginning of the reading, he says, a focus on momentum lets us consider subject and object alike as projections of the underlying energy of second level time. Now, this talk about projections we'll come back to later because I think it's really important. Here we're just saying, okay, there's a momentum which projects subject and object in the whole world of ordinary time, really. But there's also an underlying momentum. And he talks, this whole first paragraph is really important, so let's look at it, let's read it. He says, a focus on momentum lets us consider subject and object alike as projections of the underlying energy of second-level time. So when I said before that this is such a wonderfully clear presentation, it's because he's making this distinction so clearly. There's first-level momentum, and then there's this underlying energy of second-level time. Time, and I'm going on with the paragraph, time in this second-level sense distributes experience through past and present and future. So it's not the time in which the past gives way to the present, gives way to the future. It's an energy that distributes experience in these different modes of past and present and future. And it presents the logos that informs the first level temporal order. We'll come back to that. Its dynamic allows knowing to build up and interpret a world. So we have a world, first level knowledge builds it up, interprets it, structures it in terms of, you could say, first level space and first level time. But all of that is only possible because of this underlying energy. And he goes on to say that as active vitality, time is the essence of our being and our becoming, on which we feed and draw our sustenance. So what he's really inviting us to do here, that paragraph is such a nice summary of everything that's going on in this shift that he's encouraging. And it's really, at this point, it's very clearly a shift to a second level understanding of time, or a second level time. And that's what we want to look at now. So the momentum, so at the beginning of the next paragraph, he says, by focusing on this momentum, so this is not the momentum of the self, right, of lower level time. It's by looking, maybe the way to say that is that by looking at momentum instead of looking at what gets presented, what gets set up, we're automatically making a shift. So maybe you could say at first level momentum leads us into second level time if we make that the focus. I'm not sure that's right. That's sort of a way I'm formulating it right now, but let's look at it. It's not anyway the usual momentum of the self. Remember a quote that we've talked about in the past that I love from Love of Knowledge. It says, the force of the self's desire unfolds as the momentum of linear time. So the self with its desires and the momentum of linear time are intimately interrelated. That's not this momentum, or maybe you could say, as I was saying before, the focus on that momentum shifts us out of linear time. Because in linear time, we don't usually look at the momentum, we look at the events in time. Okay. So what happens if we focus on momentum is, he says here, outsiders disappear and there is no longer an interaction of subject and object as established entities. In the interaction of subject and object, there is just the interaction itself, a pure happening. That's the fundamental shift that we're looking at. So that we're looking only at interactions. So at this point, let's go back and look for a moment at the word projection. And I want to use that idea of subject and object as projections, which is in the first paragraph. I want to use that as the basis then for an exercise. So let's take a few minutes to set that up. So if we go back and look at that in terms of this notion that subject and object are no longer entities, right? Outsiders disappear. And in the interaction of subject and object, there's just the interaction. There isn't the subject, there isn't the object, there's just the interaction. Which is a fundamental shift, if we can go there. So he presents that then in a way that relates to the beginning of the first paragraph, subject and object as projections of the underlying energy of second level time. So the notion here is that a projection never becomes substance. It never becomes anything solid or real. And the word projection is a good place to look at that because what typically happens is that we make, in order to create substance, or in order to live in a world where substance is what counts, or identified entities, including events, in order to live in that kind of world, we turn things into nouns. This is this and that is that. And so everything has its name, its label. And projection is an example of a noun. But there are some nouns like projection or like creation, which we will look at later because it's discussed extensively in the reading. There are some nouns where the verbal aspect is built into the noun. More so than others. If we say table, in theory you could say, well, the act of making the table is built into the table. But we don't hear that, we don't think about it, it feels a little artificial and strained. But in English, these words that end with T-I-O-N, not all of them, but some of them, have this verbal quality. And it seems like it's especially true with projection, because To project is a very active verb. On the other hand, you know, when we think about something, when we think about a project, it's still there, but we kind of lose the verbal aspect. We think about it as a particular thing that we can identify and describe and write out and submit grant money, so submit grant applications to get money for our project, and so on. Here we are looking at projection in a way that is meant, I think, to keep us in the verbal dimension, right? So consider subject and object alike as projections of the underlying energy. So something gets projected. It's verbal. There's this ongoing activity, which is the projecting. And I think that's what is meant when we talk about projections. You could talk about projections as having substance. And in psychology, the way that they talk about projections, generally, I think, is more in this way that turns something into an identity. You know, we project our anger onto somebody else, or we project our disappointment onto somebody else and judge them negatively, that kind of thing. So the act of projecting is there, but the projection becomes for us this reality. And I guess you could say that psychology is partly about trying to make the shift back from the projection as what we think of as being real, so that we discover that we, in fact, are doing the projecting. So in that sense, it's related to what's being said here. The self has its projects, but it's always just projecting them. There's an exercise in Love of Knowledge you may remember called Protecting and Projecting. I think it's exercise 20. Which is about this, the way that we project a world, we create a world, but we project it as something that is substantial. Here, we are looking at the projecting as an ongoing activity. And so again, when we look back at the description at the beginning of the chapter, that's what we're talking about. Subject and object are projections of the underlying energy of second level time. So what we would like to be able to do, and this is a kind of a fundamental instruction or suggestion or approach to make the shift from our ordinary understanding into second level time, is we'd like to be able to stay with that dynamic activity of time and see whatever arises as a projection in this particular sense that we have been discussing now. So, that projection, which stays as an expression of the dynamic of time, we've looked at that in a lot of different ways already. I see there's a question here from Michael. He says, when you call projection verbal, are you saying that projection is always an act of naming? Well, no, I don't think so. But if we're operating in our ordinary way, then when we talk about a projection rather than the act of projecting, then I think, yeah, it is an act of naming or at least identifying. It doesn't mean that we... You know, if I project my guilt onto you, I'm just talking in sort of pop psychology terms, but if I project my guilt onto you, well, I've labeled you in a certain way. That doesn't mean that I've necessarily given you that name or that description. You're guilty. But that's how I'm seeing the world. That's how I'm setting up the world. So that is an act of naming in that sense, even if it doesn't necessarily words. But the projecting that we're talking about here doesn't do that. And that's the whole point. The projecting that we're talking about here is just an ongoing projection. It's everything that shows up, or maybe the better way to say that, maybe I'm coming back more, I'm coming around to the other side a little, maybe a better way to say that is we do project, we do have an act of naming, but if we are in tune with the dynamic of second level time, we see that that is an act of projection. So the naming, the name doesn't take hold, but the act of naming, which is what you refer to, Michael, that's what's going on. So the projecting maybe does always have that quality. You know, I don't want to say always because I haven't thought it through, but it seems as though the projecting, the projection is an act of establishing, but it's an act of establishing, or it's an active establishing. And that shift, you know, it's a very subtle shift in a way, but it's, I think it's easy enough to understand once you get what Rinpoche is pointing at. And then because it's easy enough to understand, I think it's also relatively easy if we make that our aim to see the world in that way, to make that shift, that you know, to activate a new vision. So Ken says, projection seems more intentional than arising. Yes, I think that's right. Now, the word arising doesn't particularly come up here, and maybe you're suggesting if we saw things in terms of arising rather than projecting, we would be living in a different way and with a different vision. And I think that's probably right, if that's what you're suggesting. And that would be a way to practice. I think here, you could say that because we're looking at this activity of projection, there's a couple of different levels. One is you could say the self projects, and that goes back to that quote about the self's desires, right, unfolding as the momentum of linear time. So the self projects its own needs and wishes and desires. That also is the focus of that exercise from love of knowledge, the protecting and projecting. But then there's a second level of projecting, or it's actually a more, it's a deeper level of projecting, which is the one that's referred to in this first sentence. Subject and object themselves are projections of the underlying energy of second level time. Now, how does it come to be that they get projected? Why is it, what is the intention, to stay with that term, Ken? What is the projection that leads them in that direction? Well, I'm thinking back to again to a discussion in Love of Knowledge where Rinpoche says the self has this fundamental need to exist. And so it projects itself and it projects a world. And that's this kind of projection. Why does the self have that need to exist? Well, I don't want to go too far in that direction, but it has to do with, and we've looked at this before, it has to do with the fact that it's all a projection. and the self is not satisfied with being a projection. So it has to insist on its own actual substantial existence. And so it projects itself and its world, or projects, let's say, subject and object, as a reality. And that stays an act of projection. So Caroline follows up on that. How does not projecting alter the perception of what is arising? So there seem to me to be a couple of possibilities, and we're talking about words here that are fairly elusive to pin down. So I may not be responding exactly to the question you raise, but it seems like there's a couple of possibilities, and introducing the word arising helps us see that. One possibility would be to let go, you might say, of the need to project, and simply allow the arising of what appears. And that is a practice we've done before, and really that is the practice of exercise 14, which was the assigned exercise for this first week. We've looked at it before in terms of that lovely passage on page 99 of Dynamics of Time and Space, which we worked with before. It has to do with simply appreciating, and that's another word we've looked at, simply appreciating the arising of whatever appears. So in that sense, you would say, in order to appreciate arising, to perceive in an appreciative way, you need to let go of your usual projecting, which has to do with the needs and desires of the self. That's one way of approaching this. Here, we're about to launch into a slightly different way of doing it, although it's very closely related. And that is to recognize that the self is engaged in acts of projecting, or as is suggested here, the self itself is an act of projecting or projection, right? Or, yeah, that subject and object alike are projections of the energy of second level time. So here we accept that intentional thrust to project forward. But by continuing to recognize that it's a projection, that it's a verb, it's an ongoing activity of projecting, we cut through the first level structures that get created in that way, the temporal order or the logos. If we have time, we'll talk a little about those terms again today. So that's a little bit different practice. And so that leads us pretty close now to the practice that I had in mind to have us do right now. Let's see if I can take us there. The key here is to stay with the aliveness of time, and both these different possibilities of appreciating the arising and understanding the dynamic of projecting, they both have to do with focusing on the aliveness of time rather than what gets projected, right? They're two different ways of doing it, you could say. And that's really presupposed in that second sentence of the second paragraph on page 77. In the interaction of subject and object, there is just the interaction itself, a pure happening. And then the paragraph goes on to point out that the moment you call it an interaction, you're kind of turning it into a thing again. But that's just the way our language works and our usual ways of knowing work. And then he says, at the very bottom of the page, he says, if we can look past this bias to turn everything into an outsider, into a structured something, substantial something, if we can look past that bias, then a new vision emerges. And whenever we see the word vision, our eyes should open wide and our ears should perk up, because we're talking about activating a new vision, right? So so here, this is a kind of a suggestion about how to activate a new vision. It's a very clear suggestion. And that is to look past the bias toward making everything into a substantial entity or an outsider, or to turn everything in, you know, let words convince us that what they name is real, none of which is so. If you know, in this new vision, and in this new vision, to go to the next page, we no longer see primarily substances and things. Instead, we can explore a new possibility that the character of existence is built up out of and through the momentum of time. So our way into the momentum of time here that we're going to look at and practice with for a few minutes is through projection, right? Recognizing that there's an ongoing activity of projecting a world of subject and object. And at a different, slightly different level, there's the ongoing activity of projecting the self's needs and desires. That's you know, we've talked about that, but I'm kind of setting that aside now. We're working at this deeper level. So at that deeper level, the practice is to be aware of everything as a projector, as a projection, and to help clarify, I hope it'll clarify, you know, how one would go about doing that. Just think about a movie projector. 20 years from now, nobody will even know what a movie projector is, but we presumably all still do. If you think about a movie projector, there's always the activity of projecting, right? The light is always projecting an image, and what that image is depends on the film that is passing in front of the projector. But there is this ongoing activity, and what you see on the screen is the content of what's projected. So we're shifting away from the content and toward the projecting. Now, the reason I thought it might be helpful to give that analogy to a movie projector is that you might at first say, well, that's boring. You know, if you're watching a movie and all that you're aware of is the act of projecting, you lose sight of or you lose contact with the content, and it's just always the same thing, right? The projector keeps projecting, and it's still projecting, and it's still projecting, and it's still projecting. So clearly that can't be the right image or the right way of thinking about this. And I think the way to make the shift and realize what's, you know, how you can work with this in a productive way is to say that the images show up. And that's a part of the activity of projecting. We shouldn't get too hung up on the light source in the movie projector. There's this ongoing activity of projecting an image. And then the thing that shifts it out of the analogy to the movie projector is there's our reaction to those images. So movies don't really just consist of the film that runs through the projector. You could analyze them in that way, but it's very misleading. Movies consist of the image that's projected as part of the ongoing act of projecting and how we construct and how we react to the projected image. You know, the image is meant to engage us. So in the act of seeing a movie, once you're kind of tuned in to the notion of projecting, what's happening from moment to moment is our reacting to the images that are being projected. That ongoing projection includes us as well. That's the way I think it's helpful to think about the movie projector and not in our usual sense, which is, you know, would be kind of boring. So our reaction, our interpreting, is an intimate part of the projection. And that really, I think, when you get to that level, now you begin to see how it's helpful to see both subject and object, or, you know, I'm inclined to say self and world, as projections of second level time. So everything, there is nothing in our experience that isn't part of that projection. We don't stand outside it, which of course is our usual bystander model. So the practice of seeing the ongoing projection as a projection, as an act of projecting, that helps us break through the commitment to substance and instead focus on the ongoing dynamic momentum of time. So that's the practice I'd like us to do. It took us a little longer to set it up than I thought, but I think this is the essential point. So I hope that's clear. We're looking at the activity of projecting. We're looking at the verbal structure of our reality, the momentum, the aliveness of time. I'll say maybe one more thing, and then we'll do the practice. Some of you are probably familiar, or at least have heard of, Buckminster Fuller, who was a very charismatic, innovative, inventor kind of person who enjoyed some fame in the, well, for several decades, actually. And when it came time for him to write his autobiography, the title that he gave it was, I Seem to Be a Verb. I Seem to Be a Verb. And I think that's a very nice summary way of describing what we're talking about here. The act of projecting that is inherent in projection. So why don't we do that for a few minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, and the that that we're going to do is let experience arise and be aware of it as a projection of the dynamic of time, instead of going right to the substance of what's projected. Let's try that. Okay. So, I invite your comments, descriptions, questions, and so on. While we are waiting for people, let me go to a question that Caroline posts in the chat box as a follow-up to her earlier question. She says, so is it accurate to say that we are a projection of time? And I think there's a very simple answer to that, just on the level of the text. Yeah, that's exactly what the text says. The subject and object are projections of second-level time. So you might expand on that a little bit, or let me expand on that a little bit. If we say, well, the self or I am a projection of time, I'm kind of undercutting myself in the act of making that statement because I'm assuming that there is a self, a me, and then I'm saying that self is a projection of time. But in fact, it's all the things that go to make up, all the things that we ordinarily kind of lump together to and apply the term self or me to. Those are projections of time. So in doing the practice, I was aware of a certain kind of energy or tension or a certain kind of and a certain kind of emotionality maybe underneath that. And those seem to be somewhat more finely grained descriptions of what time is projecting. Right? If you just say the self, you may not get very far. But I think it's accurate to say that this thing that we call the self is a projection that then gets identified in that particular way, is a projection of time. And that's part of what I had in mind when I pointed toward that title of Buckminster Fuller's book, I seem to be a verb. Ileana says, I see that there are some elements or qualities necessary to engage the momentum, intention to be aware, interest, a connection, and an inner openness. Otherwise, a disconnection takes place, and the momentum turns into substance. Okay, I think that's good. I think the one way to do this exercise to begin to be aware of what's going on or what's at stake is to see the ways or the aspects of our ordinary way of experiencing that prevent us from doing the exercise, that make us turn everything into substance. What brings about that disconnection that you name here, Eliana? And then maybe from that you could see what are the qualities that make it doable. And the ones you've named are very good places to look. The intention to be aware, interest, a connection, and an inner openness. I think you could come at it from a lot of different perspectives and name a lot of different factors that need to be involved or that can be, should be, helpfully are involved. But that's a nice set. And the fundamental point you're making here is a really good one. It's just as much practicing to see what binds us to substance. Ileana adds another sentence here. Disconnection is linked to judgments and resistance to being aware. Right. Yeah. So what is this disconnection? It would be interesting to look for some other words that are related to disconnection, but nothing comes to me right now, except for the notion that gets talked about later in this chapter. Rinpoche says we're outside of time, and you could say we're ordinarily outside of time. And then you could say, well, that being outside of time, that's the disconnection from the dynamic momentum. And in other places, Rinpoche talks about freezing the momentum, which is another way of looking at that. Okay, Sudi says, it seems that with this discussion in mind, then the skillful means of Vajrayana practices, of one imagining themselves, so you imagine yourself as arising as a deity in the world, as a pure environment, all day long, as one goes on engaging their life, is almost invoking this vision that is being discussed. Yeah. So you know, I'm always a little hesitant to connect this back up to Buddhist practices, but I do think you could say that in a practice like that, just going with your description, Sudi, that does have to do with engaging a different temporal dynamic, or maybe you could say engaging this second level dynamic. Although you'd have to ask then, why? You know, and what? How can you be so sure? Is that just another projection, or is it, you know, a projection in the sense of you project something and you say that's real? Or does it help you stay more connected with the act of projecting, the dynamic itself? And there is something perhaps about the, what can you say, the kind of divine dimension of that kind of practice, which puts us more in touch with the dynamic of time. But that would be important to look at. Ken says, projection, a first-level summation. Projecting is more second-level. So, yeah, this is the distinction. This is definitely one way of talking about the distinction. Projection, and then there's something that's been projected, and that's the first-level summation. Projecting, which is more second-level. The self doesn't move from first to second. Right, the self is the one that doesn't move. That's kind of the definition. The self is the one that takes a position that and says, this is the way things are. And now it's stuck. Now it's frozen. Now it's disconnected from the dynamic of time. Unless you say, moving moves. Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean there, Ken, but there is this general point. And Rinpoche talks about it somewhere in here. In the reading, I'm not quite sure where. He says, it's not that you have to throw away or get rid of the ordinary conventions of our experience. He says at one point, you know, it might seem that this is a kind of dangerous way of looking because we have to give up our usual structures. And the answer is no, you don't have to give them up. You have to see the moving, you have to see the projecting, you have to see the dynamic of time. And then in a sense, things stay the way they are, but the focus now is on the are instead of on the way. That's one way of talking about it. Okay. A couple more comments, which I want to get to, and then we're really out of time. So John says, what is most helpful in this awareness we are exploring is focusing on me as a projection because it makes my reactions and stories about reality, other projections, and myself less pivotal and weighted. If I don't strongly include myself as projection, then projection becomes a story of the self about reality. Yeah, and we've been kind of going back and forth between those two senses of projection. I think the way you put it is very good, and it relates to what I was saying in reaction to what Eliana posted, I think, that the self is, as soon as we talk about the self, we've already kind of accepted the outcome of the act of projecting. In a way that cuts against the dynamic of time. And it's very helpful to go to a level where you're more aware of the different aspects of your experience that the self calls my experience, right? And so you give some examples here, my reactions, my stories, the way things are, reality, other projections. All those things are ongoing. And yes, that's where this practice, I think, leads us. And Michael says, and this will be the last one. Along with acts of projection, there is also the arising, of sentience. Thinking of ourselves as a self, as being the subjective pole of a subject-object relationship, is only possible because we are in the midst of sensations, perceptions, impulses, feelings. Might it be that we can appreciate being a sentient being without going directly to our ordinary projections? It seems that this might allow us to appreciate projections as an aspect of being alive, and this appreciation can allow the dynamic of time to be more present. Well, there's a lot in that. We've talked a little about appreciation already, and I think that plays in very much. I personally like to remind myself sometimes that the word being, being a sentient being, is an interesting word because it's so much of a verb. You know, we talk about human beings, but what we're talking about is a human way of being. We're talking about a being. It goes back to the sense that we really be. You know, it's because we be that we are. That sounds kind of self-evident, but maybe you know what I'm saying, trying to say. So yes, if we can appreciate our own sentience, you know, and all of these aspects of it, you know, without tying it down, without labeling it, without making it this and that, if we just go into the aliveness, then yes, the dynamic of time will be more present. And that is what we're trying to engage. I think that Rinpoche's discussion of creation in this chapter, or this reading that we had, is very helpful in that regard, and it's another great example of a verb, of creating, that turns into something really fixed, creation. So maybe I'll say a little bit more about that in the transition, and go back over some of the material that we didn't get a chance to talk about. Okay, thank you very much, everybody.